You put big government, splintered religion, religion not being relevant in the public square, and then new sexual values gaining prominence. That creates all of the condition for our current religious liberty disagreements.
This is Family Policy Matters with NC Family President John Rustin.
Thanks for joining us this week for Family Policy Matters. Today we will be discussing one of our culture's most intense debates, the intersection between religious liberty and discrimination. Considering the current state of discourse in our nation, many wonder how we, as people of faith, can be persuasive and effective voices for truth in this arena. Our guest today is Dr. Ryan Anderson, the William E. Simon Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, one of our nation's leading voices in the debates around marriage and religious liberty. Dr. Anderson has published three important books on marriage, and his research has been cited by many, including U.S. Supreme Court Justices Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas. Ryan is here today to discuss the topic of his newest book, Debating Religious Liberty and Discrimination. This new book is a point-counterpoint that brings together leading opposing voices in the culture war. Dr. Ryan Anderson, welcome to Family Policy Matters. It's great to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be with you.
Well, it's a pleasure. Now, Ryan, you are quite an accomplished author. As we begin, tell us about your new book. Who are your co-authors, and why did you tackle this topic as a group, especially considering that one of the other authors, as I understand it, tends to have a completely different perspective than you when it comes to issues like marriage?
Yep, so that's exactly why we tackled this project as a group, was one of the next major debates that's going to take place in the United States, especially for people of faith, is what is the status of religious believers who are pro-life, who are pro-traditional marriage, who are hesitant about some of the new gender ideology and transgender identities that are being promoted, what will be their status in American public life? Will Catholic hospitals have to do sex reassignment surgeries? Will evangelical bakers have to bake same-sex wedding cakes? Will Mormon schools lose their nonprofit tax status or their accreditation because they teach about marriage in accordance with Mormon understanding? Those are the sorts of disagreements that are coming to a fore right now. We just saw the Supreme Court's going to be reviewing the case of one of the bakers who's been told he has to bake same-sex wedding cakes. So the book is a point-counterpoint book. John Corvino, he's a philosophy professor in Detroit. He's a person that I would identify on the political left side of the spectrum, progressive or liberal. He's pro-choice on abortion. He's pro-gay marriage. He himself is married to a man. So we disagree about all those underlying issues. We also disagree about many of the religious liberty issues. And so what we do in the book is we try to present the best arguments on both sides of the debates about religious liberty. What we want for readers is to come away better understanding their own position and the other position, and possibly modifying their position. You know, you might come in and read this book and say, wow, like, you know, I was wrong about some things. I was right about some other things. By hearing the best arguments on both sides of this debate, it's better informed me on what I should believe, where I should come down on the debate.
When it comes to balancing what may be considered by some to be competing interests like protecting religious liberty and avoiding unjust discrimination, how do the values of tolerance, respect, and acceptance come into play in this whole discussion?
Sure. I mean, so it's always important in terms of tolerance and respect that we are respectful of other people. But that doesn't mean that we should be respectful of all decisions or that we should agree with all opinions. There are some opinions that we have to disagree with, even as we respect the person who holds that opinion. And that, I would say, is the most challenging thing in American public life, is being able to make that distinction between respecting individuals while not always agreeing with actions and while not always agreeing with opinions. And too often in America, it gets conflated that if you disagree with someone, you must therefore be disrespecting someone. And if you disagree with someone's actions, therefore you must not have respect for the dignity of the individual who made that action. And that's just fundamentally flawed. I mean, what we're seeing, especially as we have moral disagreement, is that I can think abortion is a bad choice while still having respect for the dignity of the person that chose to have an abortion. That, I would say, is one of the biggest rhetorical challenges for American culture right now, is how to disagree without being disagreeable.
Right.
Well, how to voice these arguments while still being respectful.
Well, absolutely. Well, that kind of poses the question, how did we get to where we are? Why do you think the discourse on these topics of marriage, religious liberty, discrimination, and faith have degraded so much in our culture?
Yeah, so I mean, I think there are a couple of different answers. I think part of this is a self-inflicted wound. You think about faith communities, churches in the United States over the past 50 years, there's been within the Protestant side of the aisle, kind of a liberalization of mainline Protestant churches. As that took place, you then saw the rise of evangelicalism. But evangelicals never had the respect of the mainstream culture in the way that the mainline churches did. So they weren't kind of a culture-shaping institution. They were a counterculture institution. Something similar happens on the Catholic side of the aisle after the Second Vatican Council. You see Catholics who are the spirit of Vatican II Catholics going along more and more with the culture. So, and then you see the JP2 generation of Catholics, which, you know, I would count myself in that category. So part of it there is that you just see a splintering of a religion in the United States between evangelicals and JP2 Catholics on the one side that are more Orthodox and vibrant, and then mainline churches and spirit of Vatican II Catholics. You also see a challenge from secularism. You know, the understanding that religion is personal, and because it's personal, it has to be private. That wasn't the founder's understanding. Religion was important. It was personally important, but it also had a public role. The Naked Public Square says religion is constrained to your church and your bedroom, but it's not relevant to Main Street or Wall Street. And then I would say beyond this, the sexual revolution. I mean, we can't discount what took place in the 60s and the 70s to change how we think about our bodies, how we think about marriage and the family. When you then put these things together, it's not surprising the religious liberty challenges that we have, especially when you couple them with the rise of the modern nation state. The government has grown significantly in the past 50 years. So if you put big government, splintered religion, religion not being relevant in the public square, and then new sexual values gaining prominence, that creates all of the conditions for our current religious liberty disagreements.
You're listening to Family Policy Matters, a resource from NC Family. To listen to our radio show online and for more resources that will help you be a voice of persuasion in your community, go to our website at ncfamily.org.
So how do we restore respectful and fruitful dialogue in our personal and political discussions on these important topics while at the same time not surrendering our fundamental beliefs?
Yeah, I mean, we do this. I mean, partly this is why I wrote my half of this book. We do this by making good arguments that are accessible to the people we're speaking to. So I don't make theological arguments. I make philosophical and sociological, and, you know, using social science, using philosophy, using reason and evidence that a secularist could grasp, could understand. You know, if I make a biblical argument to someone who doesn't accept the authority of the Bible, it won't go very far.
Right.
So I try to make arguments that other people can access and do it in a way that is friendly, that's civil. So I think part of this is just when you say, you know, how do we restore civility while also defending our views? It's simply by doing it. Don't roll over. Don't back down. Don't mute yourself. Don't censor yourself. But when you do speak, do it in a way that is intelligent and civil. And so I hope that the book actually provides resources to your listeners on how to do that.
Now, Ron, I know you include in the book a very interesting discussion of the double standard that is applied to speech versus action that results in concrete versus dignitary harms. Talk about that a little bit more.
Sure. Yeah. So if you think about classical liberalism, the liberalism of someone like J.S. Mill, so not modern liberalism, but classical liberalism. This was the idea that people had rights and consenting adults had rights to do things provided they didn't cause harms to other people. And the types of harms, when J.S. Mill talks about his harm principle, he's talking about material, physical, tangible harms. And so as a result, free speech doctrine was, look, you can say in the United States, provided it's not direct defamation or fighting words, things that will cause physical, tangible, material harms. You can more or less say whatever you want, even hate speech. There's no hate speech exception to the First Amendment protections for free speech. But then people realized, wait, this leaves too much room for freedom. So people who don't like this much freedom said, if we just limit it to material, physical harms, there'll be too much freedom. So we're going to come up with a new category called dignitary harm. And that the idea here is that there are certain things that you could do that while not causing material or physical harms, they harm the dignity of the individual. And the double standard here is that this is being applied to religious liberty, but it's not being applied to speech. We're now seeing legal scholars say, oh, but if you're a religious person and you engage in religious action, whether it's the baker, the florist, the photographer, those acts cause dignitary harm, and that harm can override the religious liberty protection. That can be the reason why we don't grant a religious liberty exemption. And so they're kind of loading the dice, and it creates this double standard that they don't count dignitary harm against the liberties that they like, but they do count dignitary harm against the liberties that they dislike.
Well, and we're seeing that in lots of different venues around the country. The Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has issued some important decisions on religious liberty recently. What sort of legal trends do you see in the decisions that the court has issued thus far? And as far as what direction you expect these things to go? And is there cause for hope for those of us who hold religious liberty as one of our most important fundamental rights?
Well, I mean, so obviously the appointment of Neil Gorsuch and then the confirmation by the Senate was very good. But obviously that just keeps the status quo because he was replacing Scalia. And so we more or less have kept the balance where it is. So the big question will be, will there be a retirement or otherwise a vacancy in the next 3 years? And who will the president nominate? And will the Senate confirm that person? Because that's when you could see a change in power.
Right.
What was very nice to see was that we had a 7-2 decision on the Trinity Lutheran case. It didn't split down as a 5-4. It was 7-2. And so we have 7 Supreme Court justices saying a state cannot deny a religious institution a public benefit that they otherwise are qualified for simply because they're religious. So that's very encouraging that that one was 7-2, not 5-4. They announced they're going to review the Baker case. I imagine that this will be a 5-4 decision, but who knows? I think a lot will depend on where Justice Kennedy comes down. I think what we need to do for the lawyers who will be litigating this case, but also people in the broader culture, is just explain that what took place here. The Baker didn't discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. He has no problem serving gay or lesbian customers, doing happy birthday cakes, doing get well soon cakes, get well soon flowers are more typical, but he has no problem doing any sort of a cake product for a gay or lesbian customer, with the one exception of a wedding cake. He can't do a wedding cake for something that he thinks isn't actually going to be a marriage.
Right.
And that's not discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. That's simply a disagreement over the nature of what marriage is. And we shouldn't be penalizing every disagreement as if it's unjust and unlawful discrimination. So we'll see what happens. I mean, that's going to be the big case to watch.
Well, and we can all participate by praying for the attorneys, for the individuals involved in these cases, and especially for those justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. I want to encourage all of our listeners to continue to do that. And I also want to encourage our listeners, Ryan, to get a copy of your new book, Debating Religious Liberty and Discrimination, so that they can avail themselves of the incredibly helpful information that is included in that. Where can they go to get a copy of that book and your other writings?
Sure. I mean, the easiest place is just going to Amazon. If you go to Amazon and you type in the title of the book, Debating Religious Liberty and Discrimination, or you type in my name, Ryan Anderson, it'll pop out. You'll see a couple other books there. There's a book that I wrote 2 years ago titled Truth Overruled, The Future of Marriage and Religious Freedom, which was a response to the Obergefell decision. So that's still very relevant, especially as this Baker case goes to the Supreme Court. I discuss his case in that book. And then you can pre-order a book that'll be out in the winter titled When Harry Became Sally. The subtitle of that is Responding to the Transgender Moment. And that's what the book is about. That book is in the editing process right now. It'll be out in the winter. But that's specifically about how should we respond to this transgender moment that we find ourselves in.
Well, great. Well, thank you for that. Let me mention the name of your book again, Debating Religious Liberty and Discrimination by Dr. Ryan Anderson. And listeners, please avail yourselves again of this great information. And with that, Dr. Ryan Anderson, I want to thank you so much for being with us on Family Policy Matters and for your incredibly important work in researching and writing about these fundamentally important matters for the benefit of so many across our country. We're extremely grateful for you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Family Policy Matters, a production of NC Family. To listen to our radio show online and for more valuable resources and information about issues important to families in North Carolina, go to our website at ncfamily.org and follow us on Twitter and Facebook.